Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great-tasting, high-quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
Hello, hello. You're listening to Let's Eat In on Heritage Radio Network. We're here at Roberta's Pizza on a really nice, crisp fall Monday. And we're joined by a famous restaurateur and one of the two founding brothers of the Blue Ribbon Restaurant Group. It is Eric Bromberg, not Bruce, sorry.
Yep.
Hey, so, Kathy. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
You came all the way down from Danbury, or around Danbury, Connecticut, just to join us for a pizza and radio show. And so you guys, you must eat at a different restaurant of yours every night, no?
That's pretty true. I rarely get a chance to eat at other places. If I'm in New York, eating in one of my places.
Right, that's fun. You know, it's a family business too. So
yeah, that's how we keep things organized and consistent, and make sure everything's happening right.
Right on. So just to back up, the original restaurant, Blue Ribbon, in Soho, opened in 1992, I believe.
1992, November 3rd.
And in that time, over the course of the year, it was named the best new restaurant by Zagat.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure many would-be restaurateurs would be dying to know your secrets, because I hear statistics like 90% of restaurants fail in the first year. And how do you do it?
Restaurant's kind of a tough thing. I think all business, all entrepreneurial business is kind of a tough thing. But with... I don't know if there's a secret to success, but I think something that we've started from the beginning is you have to have a passion and a real love of what you do. And, you know, that's kind of the first ingredient. The second ingredient is, I guess, you got to have a good idea, because you can be passionate about a bad idea and nothing really works out. But we really built the place ourselves and from our hearts, and we never looked at making a restaurant to be, what do we think other people want to eat, or what do we think this neighborhood, you know, what's going to sell, or what's going to be economically, you know, successful for us. We always measure success in kind of being happy and comfortable with what we're doing. So Bruce and I just really made a restaurant that we wanted to eat at and be at, because we knew we were going to be there 18 to 20 hours a day, seven days a week. My wife was there with us when we started, and actually for the first almost 8 years until we had our first child. But it was Bruce and I, Ellen, and all our friends. So we just wanted to cook what we loved cooking. Food we thought was delicious, and we made it basically in a selfish way. We made it just for ourselves, and the fact that other people liked it was kind of a bonus.
Right, but you and your brother both paid your dues. You both trained at the Cordon Bleu, and
yep, we both worked in France. We both learned in France. We traveled a lot when we were younger. Our parents took us to Europe, and we got a good taste of it, and around the U.S. tasting all different kinds of food and all different restaurants. And then we both trained at Le Cordon Bleu in Paris and worked in a variety of restaurants there. You know, as much learning the culture and the, not just recipes, but in France, the love for food and the respect for recipes and dishes and your guests is really something unique, and we really, you know, gave us the base and the foundation.
Right, and that shines through with the original Blue Ribbon, but it was a more of an eclectic mix of cuisines. Maybe that has to do with some of your traveling around the world.
Yeah, that really, you know, honestly, we learned French technique and French cooking and love for that, but being New Jersey kids, we grew up in the shadow of Manhattan, so on weekends, our dad would take us to Soho or take us to the Upper East Side or take us to Midtown and go to some special place, whether it was, you know, a Japanese steakhouse where they cooked steak Kobe beef on a rock, or, you know, some interesting Indian place or smorgasbord place. We had a lot of experience, like, seeing other cultures through their food. So, you know, when it came to making the menu, we really just kind of decided we don't want any, I guess, restrictions or definition about who we were going to be and what the restaurant was going to be. So we just wanted to make foods we love, and we loved a lot of different things.
Cool. Yeah. I'm a Jersey kid too, and now I don't see why Jersey gets such a bad rap. I'm grateful for having similar experiences, you know, going to Chinatown.
Exactly.
Eating Indian food all the time. And so it's a good melting pot.
Yeah, Jersey's awesome.
Are you going to have a Blue Ribbon in Jersey? Represent.
You know, I don't know yet. We're certainly working our way through New York and enjoying that.
Cool. And what inspired the Blue Ribbon Sushi? Because there's how many restaurants total are in the restaurant group?
I think we're 10 right now.
Okay.
So, yeah, we have 4 sushi restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And the latest one being in Las Vegas, which
that's
we opened
yeah.
in December. But sushi really found a love of sushi in France, in Paris, surprisingly enough. Because living in Paris and going to French cooking school and working in French restaurants, there you needed a release in something that was just different. And there's not much that's as completely different as from French cooking as Japanese cooking. So there is an enormous difference.
Okay.
So the biggest difference between culinary styles is Asian and French. So there was a restaurant called Yakijapo in Paris. Okay. And that's where my roommate and I would go any day off, any time we had any kind of peaceful moment, and we would sit and watch the sushi chefs and just thought it was so cool how beautiful the food was and how you could see them cutting it right in front of you, and just the flavors were amazing. So grew that love, and then when Bruce and I were days off in the city, we would go to Japanese restaurants.
Uh-huh.
And
so you really wanted to eat what you
exactly.
what you put out there in the
so
world.
So we loved it, and we wanted to make it. You know, it's kind of that the same spirit of being eclectic at Blue Ribbon. It was like, well, we love sushi, so why not try and do something really special with sushi? And we found out pretty quickly that there was kind of a situation back in the early 90s, more than now, but where Japanese restaurants kind of generally treated Japanese guests better than American guests. And we would find that, like, even if we sat at the sushi bar next to a Japanese guest and they ordered a certain fish, the sushi chef would pick from one piece for them and then a different piece for us. So we decided, you know what, there's something wrong with this. And why shouldn't the rest of us get the democratic treatment and get the best everybody's mm-hmm. got? So that was kind of the mission and the beginning of why we embarked on Blue Ribbon Sushi. We really wanted to bring a cool, comfortable, pleasant, friendly, and accessible sushi to
non-biased
and just, you know, a really generous version of sushi to the American public and to our you know ourselves, really. We wanted to be comfortable in our own place. Mm-hmm. So once again, we just made a restaurant, a sushi restaurant, that was exactly where we wanted to be. And we found, we ate probably in 200 sushi restaurants over a couple of months, and found a guy named Toshi Yuki, who was, had his own place on Lexington Avenue and 30th, and he was the best sushi chef we found, and we convinced him to sell his place and become partners with us, and we've been partners ever since.
Terrific. Has he taught you how to make sushi?
You know, he has, and we still are very respectful. We'll do it on off hours, but we never do it for the guests.
Yeah.
We leave that to the masters.
Yeah, you have to go through rigorous training and all
it's,
that.
It's a lot of work, and it's a lot of technique, and it's a lot of knowledge.
Cool. And now, what is the idea behind the name Blue Ribbon? Were you guys sitting around drinking PBR one day and just
you know, funny you ask. We struggled in the beginning with what the name was going to be, and we really just wanted the name to mean something forever. And we liked the idea of, instead of having a new name for every restaurant we would do, that we wanted something that would really just engage and be long lasting. Mm-hmm. And so we with our French training, and we were American and strongly American from New Jersey, and really shaped by that, we wanted it to be, you know, somehow bridge the gap between French and okay. American. So Cordon Bleu, the cooking school we went to, is actually translated Blue Ribbon. And so that was the first light bulb idea. And then the idea that Blue Ribbon is first place, and that's what you strive to be always, is the best. So that's what we do.
Excellent. Now, do you guys still cook at home sometimes, or
cook?
You find the time?
Yeah, almost every day I'm at home. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to cook at home. I love, you know, it's kind of what I talked about being passionate about what you love to do. And the thing about being in the restaurant business that's really pretty special is that there's so many aspects of restaurant business. Whether you're behind the stove, whether you're designing or conceiving of what you're doing, whether, you know, you're involved in, like, what we're doing right now, being on the radio talking about it, TV, video, teaching. There's so many aspects that really you can keep yourself busy all the time, and there's just always another outlet, another venue. And we love cooking so much that we just essentially are always cooking.
It's always around.
Always
food.
There.
It's always circling around that. When did you know that you wanted to be a restaurateur?
That's an interesting question. It was, I guess, from little kids, always knew I wanted to make things. I didn't really know I wanted to cook. And honestly, my dad was a lawyer. And in our house, you were either a lawyer or you were... I don't know what.
You're banished.
So, not even that you were banished. There was just never really a conversation about another job.
Okay.
So it didn't even strike me that there was an option to be a chef or be a restaurateur or any of that stuff. In college, I decided that I wasn't going to be a lawyer. I was actually going to be a musician.
Mm-hmm.
And went on that for a couple of years. And then as I was graduating, realized perhaps I wasn't a good enough musician to be a musician.
What'd you play?
I played guitar.
Okay.
And I enjoyed it. But,
rock?
Rock, folk, sort of a little country-ish.
Cool.
And that was my love. But I had a partner, and he passed away and kind of lost the love, the ability to do it on my own. And a friend that I grew up with called me and said, I want to go to cooking school in Paris, and do you want to be my roommate? And so I thought about it, and honestly, the first thought was, well, that I can have two more years of school before I have to decide what I'm going to do when I grow up. And then I went to Paris, and within a couple of months of being in Paris, I completely realized that food was something I loved. I was good at it. I loved eating it, and now I knew how to make it. And so I completely, I shifted my obsession from music to food, and it's been that way ever since.
Interesting. I hear so many stories about those different arts just kind of,
you know what, it's moving. A pretty common thing to kind of have love for that artistic expression, and then sort of finding where you fit in, you know, where your talents kind of drag you.
Right. And food is also a practical obsession because you have to eat. that's what I like to say to people. It's like, you know, it's not all about haute, you know, artiste, but you gotta eat. So anyway, we're gonna just put on a quick little song, and I'll be right back with some more, hopefully, interrogations. Hey, we're back on Let's Eat In. I'm Kathy Irway, your host, and we are joined by Eric Bromberg, the co-founder of Blue Ribbon Restaurant Group, which includes Blue Ribbon Soho, Blue Ribbon Sushi, Blue Ribbon Bakery, and a few more, and a few more coming up, too. Yeah. You spoke of a rooftop sushi restaurant in overlooking Central Park.
Yep, we've actually this Tuesday, which is when? Oh, it's tomorrow. We're starting on the rooftop at the 6 Columbus Hotel. We have a rooftop garden area and a bar and sushi.
Wonderful. Are you going to really grow a few plants on the rooftop garden area?
You know, we have a couple of little plants growing. We just got started.
Okay.
So it's getting colder now, so yeah. We're kind of losing our season. We're going to start next year.
Well, spring, it's a great way to grow a few herbs to throw onto.
And exactly.
It smells wonderful. We're actually sitting below some plants.
I saw that.
If you haven't noticed. That brings me to another question. Have you seen, what are the biggest changes over the last decade or two almost? Yeah, it'll be 2 decades since you first started doing the restaurant thing in the spring. So what's some crazy stuff that's happened?
I think sort of the real exciting things that happened, maybe the biggest change, is sort of to the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, restaurants were really dominated by big, showy, front-of-the-house or investor-dominated restaurants, where chefs were really, you know, workers in the picture. They were behind the scenes. There were maybe, you know, a handful of what casual, you would consider, you know, well-known chefs.
Oh, okay.
But they were always the highest of high-end French chefs. All those right. were the people that you knew, Andre Saltner, those guys. Hmm. When we started Blue Ribbon in 92, it was really kind of the beginning of this whole groundswell of chefs making places for themselves, mm-hmm. and making their own places. And instead of somebody
putting up all these
instead of coming to work for someone, they were actually the entrepreneurs. So, you know, it started right there. And at Blue Ribbon in the very beginning, Bruce and I just kind of jumped out of the mold where we took the smallest place we could get. Mm-hmm. You know, we only have 48 seats at Blue Ribbon. And right in, you know, in Soho, which Sullivan Street wasn't really Soho at that point, but okay. kind of stretched Soho a bit. And, you know, we made a place from the kitchen out instead mm-hmm. of from the decor in. Mm. So the essence was, and actually our corporate name is Food First. And that's where we took, that was kind of our driving force. And I think all the wave since then has really been chefs have grown to be the leaders in the restaurant business instead of they're a worker behind the scenes in the restaurant business. And I think that's the most exciting, and you certainly see it, you know, everywhere in media and beyond. That, and I guess with the celebrity chef kind of aspect of things, it, you know, maybe that's a little too far, but it's just really cool to have, when you have a dream, a food dream, and you're the chef, that you can open your own place and, you know, make something really special.
Well, that's really interesting. I'm so lost here on this topic too. I don't know if you realize I went 2 years without eating in restaurants, so I'm kind of like the no, I like restaurants a lot. But yeah, that's a really interesting observation. So now that more chefs are being involved, do you think it's affected the type of food or perhaps the type of diners?
I think both. I think it's really affected the type of food. I think food is far more interesting, far more culinary in spirit, and far more inventive and exciting. And instead of really decor or style or, you know, attitude, those have taken a back seat to mm-hmm. real artistic expression. And I think it's a spectacular turn of events.
Right on. And what is your take on the farm to table movement?
I think it's extraordinarily cool. I think it's motivating millions of people to really take a look at what they're doing and what they're eating, what they're putting in their bodies, and what they're doing to the land. And I think it's a fabulous, you know, kind of spirit to drive people to do something they love. I think, you know, as in maybe any wave or trend, there's another side to it, and there's kind of a opposite to that curve, mm-hmm. which is, you know, people do like to travel. People do like to see other things. And there is an intriguing aspect to, you know, having, let's say, a product, having langoustine from Brittany mm-hmm. available in New York, at the same time having something, you know, a tomato available from 100 miles or 80 miles away. Those things both have a place, and I think the balance will be, you know, struck relatively soon. Mm-hmm. But I think the farm-to-table thing, or wave at the moment, is really, you know, it's inspiring and it's exciting, and it right. brings, especially a place like this, yeah. you know, Roberta's really kind of digs in deep, and it has a, you know, maybe the identity.
Right. And what are some of these ingredients that you can't live without, perhaps, that are that necessarily come from afar?
I think
langoustine sound pretty good.
Langoustine yeah. are pretty spectacular. Sardines.
Okay.
I think, you know, come you from the Mediterranean okay. or Portugal, and those are really, really special.
They're so ubiquitous, I forgot.
right. Anchovies. You know, I mean, to me, even throughout the United States, if you can kind of appreciate different lamb, whether it comes from Colorado or whether it comes from Pennsylvania or whether it comes from, you know, other areas throughout the country, and there's really different flavors and different tastes.
Yeah,
I think that's an interesting aspect to food. So, let's see, mostly seafood, and I guess you know, seafood is a tough thing because if you live inland and farm to table is your only mantra, you really don't eat fish. You don't have that opportunity, and perhaps you're near a trout stream, but you lose the entire, you know, seafood market. So I think there's, you know, there's a balance all around, and I think seafood's good for you. Mm-hmm. So I like kind of having the more balanced approach.
Yeah, and where does you know, the most majority of your seafood come from Blue Ribbon?
We really draw from all over the world, and as far as Japan, actually, we get most of our fish from sushi from Japan.
Right.
We also get local fish as much as possible. Obviously, you know, there's certain things that are better here than anywhere else in the world. Squid. The Northeast has the best squid in the world, except for certain varieties that are in the Mediterranean. But really, that's amazing. Northeastern lobster, there's no better lobster than Maine lobster.
Mm-hmm.
And even some Long Island lobster. So it's really, you know, I guess we go wherever we can find something special, we go for it. But we always take into consideration how it's fished and what, you know, where it's from, and we're very careful about each product we buy.
Right on. So I have to ask this question before we run out of time, because I ask this to every guest, and I think you'd be a great expert. So what is the most romantic date meal? It could be as many courses or as few as you'd like.
I think the best way to approach a date meal is to approach smaller courses and not be too full at the end of the meal, because that's always trouble.
That's not true.
But I love sushi as a date
option.
I love seafood as a date option because it's very light. The sauces are generally lighter. You can you know, I don't know, feel a little lighter on your feet at the end. Also, it's clean, a little more tasty, elegant to eat. I love lobster as a date item, and I love caviar, even though, you know, that's not always loved by everybody. But usually, you know, I would say sushi, lobster, and rack of lamb. You can't really beat rack of lamb for its elegance.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I can get with that. The little, like lollipop lamb chops.
Yeah.
Cute. These are some good suggestions. I was actually recently at, you know, getting back to the seafood and, you know, sourcing from all these different places. A lot of people think of sushi as big slabs of big, big fish. But there's, when you go to Japan, you know, and I've never been there, actually. But I hear that, you know, it's all about just all the different in-season types of fish and eggs of fish and mollusks and what have you in the sea. And
exactly. And
there's so much variety.
And we, maybe one of the coolest things that we got at Blue Ribbon Sushi is that a normal sushi restaurant may have like 6, 8, 10 fish to choose from. On any given night, we have between 50 and 60 fish available, different fish, ranging from tiny little minnows to, you know, a big tuna. But
eels,
we have eel, sardines, mackerel, all different varieties, and there's just so many different things, and they all taste so different and delicious.
I once had an oyster placed beautifully on a bit of rice, and that's so
good.
Fun. Yeah, it's always good. But
oh wait, oyster's good for date too.
Oh, yeah.
I left that out.
For obvious reasons. No. I don't know. I feel like sushi tends to get a bad rap for, you know, ideas of sustainability. When people think about tuna, they're like, oh, they're scared that it's one of these endangered species. And if anyone has those concerns, I would recommend them to try the eel and, you know, the...
I mean, there's a lot of things. It's interesting. It's kind of a hot topic right now, but sustainability and tuna, there's an enormous effort now to repopulate the bluefin tuna and to grow and raise bluefin tuna and put them back into the wild. So there are a couple of there's a Kindai tuna, which is made farmed in Japan, and they start, they actually hatch the eggs in captivity and then introduce those eggs into the wild, and they keep them safe until they're big enough. But supporting, buying that tuna kind of supports the future of the food supply.
Cool.
So it helps that process go along so more tuna can be introduced into the ocean.
Absolutely. So when you're supporting a restaurant that has these values and sources responsibly, then you're actually helping these efforts.
Yeah, exactly. So,
well, thank you for sharing that with us. And thanks again for being here on the show. I guess that's about it for us. And look out for the next Blue Ribbon Sushi at Columbus Circle next year. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. This is a message from Fork and Anchor. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anchor, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today.